I'd like now to welcome Mika Kurtz. He's co-author of the new book, Wujud, The Grassroots Guide to Israel. He's a community mobilizer. He's a lifelong resident of Jerusalem. He's also lived here in northern New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. This is a fascinating book. It's a guidebook to Jerusalem that you know well, since having lived there all your life. It contains a map and, you know, where to stay and things like that. But it's a guidebook to the Palestinian side of Jerusalem as well as other destinations.
I didn't actually write most of this book. I helped compile a lot of it, but this is a book that was authored by numerous Palestinian leaders and activists working at different community-based organizations in over 40 different communities around Jerusalem. We work with almost 80 partners around town. And this is a product of 3 years of grassroots organizing and collecting information. And it might look like a small book, but wow, a hell of a lot of people put their time and energy into it.
So how did you and your co-authors come up with this idea of this guidebook?
It's part of a larger project called Grassroots Jerusalem, the organization that I work at. We're a Palestinian organization. I'm the only Israeli there. And the idea is to put Jerusalem back on the map as the Palestinian capital. Over the last few decades, it's kind of fallen through the cracks. I don't know how many people noticed, it was 2 or 3 years ago when Secretary of State Hillary Clinton came for a visit in the Middle East, and she said, the road to peace is paved between Ramallah and Jerusalem. And that's a big international faux pas. According to international law, Jerusalem has never been recognized as the Israeli capital. Actually, the only country in the world that recognizes Jerusalem as the capital is Israel itself. The American embassy is still in Tel Aviv, as are all the rest of the global embassies. And Ramallah, historically, is a rinky-dink little village outside of Al-Quds, Jerusalem. And for the Secretary of State in the U.S. to say that is an acknowledgement of the Israeli occupation and the status quo that the military realities have created over the years. Our job at the organization is to surface that, is to make sure people understand that, especially considering if you're not Jewish in Jerusalem, you don't actually have the right to vote for a government. The Palestinian Authority has no jurisdiction in the largest Palestinian metropolis, and the Israeli government withholds civil services.
So wait a minute, even if you are a citizen of Israel, if you are not Jewish Israeli, you don't get to vote?
Palestinians in Jerusalem never received Israeli citizenship. They only received what's called residency status. It's kind of like a green card in the U.S. You don't get the right to vote for national government, but with it you do get the right to vote for the mayor, the Israeli mayor of Jerusalem. Now, if you're around in Jerusalem long enough, you realize that the decisions about Jerusalem, whether or not there'll be a new Palestinian neighborhood or master plans for Palestinian areas, are drawn up. That's a decision that's made on the prime minister level, not the mayor's office. So Palestinians promptly choose to boycott the municipal vote, considering it's kind of useless on political levels. And as such, do not have political representation. They do not have the right to self-determination.
And the guidebook format is such an interesting way of exploring that, because here you have a guidebook, and it's an interesting book because on the one hand it has this very enthusiastic tone, welcome, we're so glad you're here, so much to explore, so much to do, but then it's kind of like page by page a guidebook to an unfolding tragedy or to a tragedy gone by. For example, you talk about neighborhoods that were completely destroyed, like the Moroccan Quarter mm-hmm. in 1967.
Mm-hmm. We start a discussion about Jerusalem from East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem. That's what many people know in the world. West Jerusalem being Israeli, East Jerusalem being Palestinian. What many don't realize is that that's really new terminology considering how old the city itself is. Only since 1947, when 2,000 Jews had lost their home in what became East Jerusalem, and about 39,000 Palestinians from 30 different villages and neighborhoods lost their homes in what became West Jerusalem. Now, that's a story untold. We're supposed to consider only the framework of a two-state solution that was introduced in the 90s, which, from our point of view right now in Jerusalem, seems impossible. That's just not something that's going to happen. That was just the beginning of the story. Beyond that, sure, the Moroccan community was erased, bulldozed out. And today, decade by decade, we're witnessing layers of Israeli bureaucracies and laws and military occupation and midnight raids and child arrests and unemployment, rising unemployment rates and rising dropout rates from school that are resulting in what is essentially an ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from Jerusalem. For tourists that come to town, we're thrilled that they come, and we're saying, yeah, of course, but don't just look for where Christ walked up this road or King David took a leak on a tree. There are some realities here that people could be witnessing. Come visit the Shuafat refugee camp and understand what it means to be a refugee for 60 years living in a camp where there's upward of 70% unemployment and 220 houses have demolition orders on them. Beit Safafa is a 2,000-year-old village that right now is being destroyed by a 6-lane highway that Israel is paving through it. If you're going to be a tourist in the Holy Land, come witness, come see what's actually happening.
One of the things that I think is really also important and interesting about your book is the use of maps. And you've got a map that has a pretty accurate and comprehensive picture of Jerusalem. How does it differ from maybe an Israeli tourist map that I might pick up if I arrived at the airport?
Israeli maps, the maps that I grew up with in my high school, including Google Maps, like the mainstream maps that are used in Israel, Palestine, don't actually include whole Palestinian villages sometimes, neighborhoods of Jerusalem, street names, landmarks, schools, they're just not on the map. The map of Jerusalem that you'll receive that you get from the municipality, from the town hall that a tourist will get, with the mayor's address and signature on the bottom saying welcome to town, will show the Palestinian neighbors of Jerusalem, either non-existent, some of them aren't even there, and if they are there, they look like empty kind of gray or green national park areas. But in fact, they're densely populated neighborhoods. And so any tourist...
So they're literally not on the map?
They're not on the map.
They're just not represented.
Some of them are not on the map. Some of them are on the map, but they look like small villages, you know, with maybe a couple of hundred people still living there. You might not want to go visit because it doesn't point tourists in that direction at all. There are the tourist destinations. The center of the map is going to be the Israeli parliament, the Knesset itself, for the most part. And they'll point you in the direction of the Israeli Central Business District. Go visit there. As opposed to the older Palestinian neighborhoods, which have literally been there for millennia or two.
And include restaurants and hotels and all sorts of businesses that you point out in this book.
Right. And we're saying come and visit the other side of town. And what we've been doing over the last 3 years is through workshops identifying different community leaders and organizations and groups that are active there, women's groups or farmers associations, community councils, youth movements. We work with each one and we've been going out with GIS equipment. And let's go out and map your neighborhood. Let's start from scratch. And so we put the street names on the map, and we put the schools and the community centers and the mosques and the businesses on the map, and we publish what we call the real map of Jerusalem so that people have access to that.
I noticed you just used the word Palestine as opposed to Israel. You used the word colonies as opposed to settlements. Talk about your choice of language.
Language is like maps. It defines the reality we live in. If I say Israel, we must be in Israel. If I say Palestine, we must be in Palestine. Now, when it comes down to it, Israel, through maps and language and history books and narratives and propaganda that I grew up with, has managed to display a reality where the land, the Holy Land, the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, is considered Israel. In my geography books in high school, we don't have a green line. We consider all of it. Judea and Samaria, what's known around the world as the West Bank, is part of Israel. De facto, according to Israeli law. Settlements are a term, are a political term. Settlements were the Jewish supremacists that moved out in the 70s, capturing hilltops in Palestinian land, saying, this is ours. It has been since biblical times, and all we're doing right now is reclaiming it. And we call them settlers since 1967. The Zionist Jews that moved into Palestine after the Nakba, after what Israelis call the War of Independence, were not considered settlers. So that's our. So there's a 1947 timeline, and then there's a 1967 timeline.
Define the word Nakba.
Nakba, what's known as the Palestinian Nakba, is the reference to the 1948 war. Israelis call the War of Independence, and Palestinians call the Nakba the Palestinian catastrophe, where over 80% of the Palestinian population were displaced en masse during this period of time, from between 1947 and 49. And this is a chapter in history that is not acknowledged in Israel. It's literally not in our history books. In fact, any educational institution that will teach Nakba curriculums or commemorate the Nakba will have its funding pulled from the Israeli Ministry of Education. This is as of 3 years ago when our foreign minister, Lieberman, passed this law in Knesset. And it's called, I think that we called it the Nakba laws. When we discuss Jerusalem, we try to reframe it. It helps us transcend one-state, two-state solution distractions, because those are on political levels that a lot of people find daunting, confusing, complicated. And we're trying to say, look, Jerusalem isn't complicated. This is a city. When we're talking about employment rates, we're talking about dropout rates, access to healthcare, these are as basic urban development issues as any other city around the world. Only in our case, if you're not Jewish, you don't have the right to vote. And in the largest Palestinian metropolis, since Israel built a wall 10 years ago surrounding the central business district, cutting the workforce out in the suburbs, 5,000 businesses have shut down in the central business district, and unemployment rates in the suburbs have rocketed to over 75%.
Now, we're talking about a city approximately the size of Albuquerque.
A little under, yeah.
Yeah.
We're a little under a million people, 360,000 Palestinians. When it comes to settlers, Israelis living across the Green Line, there are around 300,000 Israelis living across the Green Line now.
Now, what is the Green Line?
The Green Line is the armistice line that was drawn in 1949 as the ceasefire agreement, and on the basis of which the two-state solution was negotiated back in 91 and 93 in Madrid and Oslo, the Oslo Accords, the big peace agreements, when East Jerusalem was acknowledged to be the future capital of the Palestinian state. What Israel has managed to do in the meantime over the last couple of decades is make sure that there are facts on the ground, that there are Israelis living in almost every Palestinian neighborhood. And in between on the hilltops, there are large Israeli neighborhoods that fragment the fabric of Palestinian life, deeming it completely impossible right now to turn that city again into a Palestinian capital within a two-state solution.
So it's basically, I mean, it's a situation wherein you can't separate the two groups and have two different states because they're mixed, but there's no equality within the mixed situation, within the mixed city, within the mixed nation.
We have, Israel is holding an election on March 17th, the coming March 17th. Right now, this government, the Israeli government, controls all the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. It controls the resources, controls the water, the minerals, controls the people. The Palestinian Authority has authority, kind of municipal authorities in the Palestinian cities themselves, but they still receive their salaries in shekel. And if they do something, the hawkish right-wing government does not like, Israel can withhold taxes. And in essence, Israel controls that land. However, if you're not Jewish, you don't have citizenship, and you can't vote in the upcoming elections. That's over 4 million people.
It's interesting to hear all of this from your perspective, because you're a resident. You grew up there. You played on the playground when you were a kid. You went to school. And there's a section in the book, in the guidebook, we're talking about the guidebook Wujud, the grassroots guide to Jerusalem, and you ask questions like, what if your neighborhood waste management was a monthly bonfire? What if there was running water but only 6 hours a day? Sidewalks were a novelty. Playgrounds were unheard of. It goes on and on. And it seems like a real contrast between the way you grew up and the way Palestinian children grew up or are growing up now.
My neighborhood in Jerusalem can easily be confused with downtown Denver. No problem. We had great parks, green parks, community centers, swimming pools. I grew up in the Scouts. We had a youth movement. My school was great. We had sidewalks. We had running water all the time. Who knew about appreciating just having running water? Appreciating the fact that a garbage truck would come by every 2-3 days to pick up our waste. Same city.
And not very far away, within the same city.
As the crow flies 5 minutes away, none of those services. Those services are withheld by the Israeli government, even though these are tax-paying residents, and they are sure to pay taxes, because if they don't, they'll have their residency status taken away, and they'll be kicked out of town and never able to come back. And there aren't community centers. There's almost a 50% dropout rate in schools in Palestinian neighborhoods because the Israeli mayor won't build new schools, because there are around 2,000 classrooms that are missing, and kids have to go to school in shifts, afternoon, morning and afternoon, or a day on and day off, or they simply just don't go to school because there aren't enough classrooms. 45 kids on average per classroom. Now, if they do, education is an enormous issue in Palestinian neighborhoods, and probably one of all the human rights violations, the first one that comes up often is education. Because for those who do manage to complete high school and want to continue into academia, they have three options. They can go study at the Hebrew University on Mount Scopus, half of which is built on stolen Palestinian lands. Studies are in Hebrew. Probably not the first choice a local Palestinian will make.
Now, do some students make that? And if so, what is life like for them in those universities?
Well, on that campus, the campus is built just above Isawiya, one of the most impoverished Palestinian neighborhoods in Palestine, altogether. It's just right on top of it. You can see the ghetto, so to speak, from your classroom windows. For the most part, those students won't choose to go to that campus. There are Palestinian citizens of Israel that come from up north, from Nazareth, that do study on that campus. Local Palestinians who have residency status, not citizenship, won't. The other options that they have is to go to the Al-Quds University, the Palestinian University. But that campus is no longer a half-hour, 40-minute walk from the old city. There's a wall in between. So it's an hour and a half's drive, depending on traffic and checkpoints. That campus is also raided by Israeli border police at least every couple of weeks with tear gas and rubber bullets. And even then...
What do you mean? Like, they just come in and shoot people with rubber bullets?
Well, as you know, university campuses are hotbeds for political activism. And so, yes, the border
police... So anytime there's like any... So there's protests there?
There are protests there, and there's organizing there. And the Israeli border police regularly raid it. And even then, if somebody does complete a degree in Al-Quds University and come back home on this side of the wall, on the Jerusalem side of the wall, that campus is not accredited by the Israeli academia, by the Ministry of Education. So you come back to Jerusalem and still receive minimum wage in a job. It's a worthless degree in the Jerusalem economy. And the third option is you can leave town, go study in Berkeley, or go study in Beirut. But if a resident of Jerusalem leaves the city for more than 3 years, as residency status goes, you lose the residency status. You're not allowed back into town without a permit. The message to a younger generation basically is leave. You're not welcome here. You're not going to find an education. You're not going to find a house to live in, because no new houses, no new master plans have been drawn up in decades. You're not going to find a job. Unemployment rates are rocketing. Healthcare is going to be difficult to come by. The message is very clear from the Israeli government. We are asking everybody to get out of town.
So it's basically, just go away, we want your land.
Yes. In the meantime, consecutive Israeli governments, especially during the 90s, when we all thought peace was around the corner, the Labor Party had doubled the size or doubled the number of settlers from 200 to 400,000 during those Oslo Accords. And since the Camp David talks in 99-2000, the Israeli government has made sure that there are Jewish supremacists living in almost every single Palestinian neighborhood. And that's just leading up to this last summer. This last summer, we shifted gears, and now Jerusalem's a whole new city.
We're talking to Mika Kurtz about the guidebook of which he is co-author, Wujud, the Grassroots Guide to Jerusalem. It's a little guidebook, and we keep getting off on every topic to which this guidebook leads, because it's all based on land. It's based on place, on city, on urban development. And as you say, if a young person, let's say a young couple, gets out of school, sets up a household, starts to have children, it's very difficult for them if they're Palestinian in Jerusalem, because they can't build a house, they can't renovate a house. And it's like a catch-22. If they want to build a house, they can't get a permit. If they build a house without a permit, it gets bulldozed.
Right. Consecutive Israeli governments withholding civil services also means withholding the development of master plans for a neighborhood. Now, any modern city in the world, if you want to build a house or if you want to make an extension onto the kitchen into the backyard, you're going to need to get a permit from the municipality. And the way to do that is to make sure the architect sits down and makes sure the plumbing and the electricity fit the master plan. That makes sense. It makes total sense. However, if you don't have a master plan in the city, you can't do that. That's been the case for decades now in Palestinian neighborhoods of Jerusalem. Young couples, young families don't have a choice but to leave the city because of the lack of master planning. And so since these were policies that were made in the 70s, there are two priorities that were made in the 70s by the Israeli government when it came to Jerusalem. They set a demographic benchmark for the Israeli capital. They wanted to make sure that there's a majority of Israeli Jews living in the capital. About 70% majority. That's handed down by the Ministry of Interior. It's on the municipal website. I don't know of any other city in the world that actually has a race or an ethnicity-based demographic benchmark. Ours does.
That would be like if you said, you know, we have a policy that Albuquerque will be 70% white.
Yeah, for example. That's the policy in Jerusalem. So the first thing that happened in the 70s was the Israeli government started building and planting big suburbs or settlements, residential areas, community centers, strip malls, swimming pools, on the hilltops, basically Palestinian farmlands in between the Palestinian neighborhoods themselves, fragmenting the Palestinian neighborhoods and in essence also changing the ancient way of life, the indigenous way of life, the farmers. And the Israeli side of town grew as much and as fast as possible and has done since. That's been the policy, 70s, 80s, and 90s. The second priority was to freeze Palestinian development. No new Palestinian development, no new master plans have been developed since the 70s. As a result, as Israeli neighborhoods grow, during the 80s, Palestinian young couples have left basically to the suburbs, not too far away, kind of similar to any other metropolis area. Young couples and families go out and live in the suburbs, only in Jerusalem maybe twice, three times as much. So the neighboring villages, Ramallah, you'll know, Bethlehem is basically a neighborhood of Jerusalem down south that's now detached because of the wall, but it's basically a suburb. Abu Dis El Azariya and Bethany and Jericho grew with Palestinian young Palestinian couples that just moved out. It's a stone's throw away. It's not very far. It's a half-hour walk from the center of town. In the 90s, this got challenging and confusing when during the peace talks, Israel planted checkpoints in between the suburbs and the central business district. So anybody wanted to come back to work or go shopping in the marketplace or come back home and visit their family, get to the hospital, any of these everyday tasks, now had to go through an Israeli checkpoint. So that became a challenge.
Which is a long, it can be a very long wait.
It can be a very long wait. Or sometimes if you don't have a permit, you're just not allowed through. That's that. In 1995, the peak of the peace process, the Israeli Ministry of Interior coins a new phrase around the residency status, the unique Palestinian residency status in Jerusalem, saying the phrase was the center of life, is a new standard. And Israeli border police started midnight raids across Palestinian neighborhoods in the Old City and in the Holy Basin neighborhoods. Basically, 2 o'clock in the morning, banging down the door, and pouring the belongings, pouring the all the stuff off the shelves in the living room and in the bedroom and in the kitchen and interrogating a family and asking, where do you work? Do you work in Ramallah or do you work in Jerusalem? Do your kids go to school in Abu Dis, just 20 minutes down the road, or do they go to school in Jerusalem? Because if you're working in Ramallah, your kids are in school in Abu Dis, and we can't find your underwear here in the center of town, your center of life is not here in Jerusalem, and you lose your residency status. And as a result, tens of thousands of Palestinians lost the right to come home, lost the right to the largest Palestinian metropolis.
Not to mention the terror of having your house trashed in the middle of the night.
Terror, the trauma that children have to deal with later on. Right now in Jerusalem, what's coming up more and more is protests against the child arrests that happened at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Child arrests?
12-year-old, 13, 14-year-old kids are arrested in the middle of the night. They're accused of throwing stones at protests. Now, there aren't community centers. There aren't schools. There aren't basic services for kids. While in the meantime, Israeli settlers are marching around the streets claiming the neighborhood is theirs. They're protected by private security guards and border police. And kids will throw stones. This is a reality in an increasingly unemployed society, undereducated society.
It's a setup for throwing stones.
It's
really
a setup for exactly. So this began in the mid-90s and continues to this day. These midnight raids, checking where's your center of life. Do you really live here? And as a result, tens of thousands of people living out in the suburbs are no longer allowed in. Now that was in 95. By the end of the 90s, as Clinton saw that his precious Oslo Accords were falling apart, tension levels were rising. There were bombs blowing up right and left in the neighborhoods that I grew up in. Right, the number 18 bus that I take to work blew up twice. The cafes, the bars. I mean, I remember what terror looks like. And he called for Camp David. And when it came to Jerusalem, he set the Clinton parameters to Jerusalem. He tried to make it as simple as possible. He said, wherever Israelis are living will be an Israeli capital, and wherever Palestinians are living will be the Palestinian capital. This is where the Israeli government shifts gears and starts planting those Jewish supremacist residencies in the midst of every Palestinian neighborhood, making sure that that could never happen. No right. Two-state solution. So obviously tension levels will grow even more. And then the second Intifada broke out when Ariel Sharon, the father of the settlement movement, took a walk on the Temple Mount saying, this is ours, I can do whatever I want here, triggering the bloodiest Palestinian uprising and the bloodiest Israeli response, military response to it. You know, tension levels rose to an all-new peak with that Intifada, and Israel introduced the wall, saying, the wall, let's separate Israelis from Palestinians altogether. This was during the big Bush War on Terror. The drums of war were beating all over the world. You guys were, for some reason, looking for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Anything that was against terror goes. And Israel said, we'll build a wall to separate. If you look at a map of the wall today, you'll notice that the wall, what the wall manages to do is leave Israel in control of 70-75% of the Palestinian water resources in the West Bank. Israel remains in control of the international borders of a new Palestinian state and of the largest Palestinian metropolis and capital itself. In Jerusalem, what it finally did was cut the central business district off from the suburbs, as I said earlier. So unemployment rates rocketed.
So in other words, if you had a job in town and you lived in the suburbs, you couldn't go to work.
Exactly. Or get to the hospital. Or go shopping. In fact, for the first time maybe in 2,000 years, it's illegal to import, so to speak, fruits and vegetables from the farmlands in the suburbs to be sold in the old city market.
So farmers who'd been selling their fruits and vegetables forever, what happened? Where do they sell now?
They do what they can in the West Bank within the grid of checkpoints and the control that Israel has, the military control. But otherwise, the largest metropolis is dying. The economy is dying. And it's changed everything, not just the economy. If you can imagine, Israel imports produce from elsewhere to be sold in the old city market. It changes the diet. It changes the ancient diet. We've changed the city. The ancient city of Jerusalem, just over the last 3, 4, 5 decades, has completely changed from what it has been for the last 2 millennia.
So how does this affect people like you, the Jewish people living there? I mean, you are obviously, you made the choice at some point to open your eyes and get involved and become an organizer. But ordinary, young Jewish 20, 30, 40-something people living in Jerusalem.
Unfortunately, on the Israeli side, and I say this sadly, we're not in our best moment historically, the Israeli streets in Jerusalem, especially after this last summer. If you followed the events of this last summer, you'll remember that the tension levels rose when 2 Palestinian boys were shot and killed outside the Ofel prison camp, outside of Ramallah, during an annual Nakba rally. Commemoration rally. Tension levels rose from there, and 3 Israeli kids were kidnapped. And the Israeli government and military brass immediately accused the Hamas for the kidnapping. And the Hamas promptly said, nope, this wasn't us. This one wasn't us. We had nothing to do with this kidnapping. Military brass continued to accuse the Hamas nevertheless. And the result was numerous midnight raids across villages and Palestinian neighborhoods in Jerusalem. Over 1,000 people were arrested for mere association with the Hamas, and tension levels rose to a whole new peak. And by the end of those 3 weeks, the bodies were found in a field outside of Hebron, in the Hebron Hills. The Israeli government orchestrated a national funeral. The prime minister gave a speech, and during that speech, accusing the Hamas of the kidnapping, he also uttered the term revenge. And that was the first time I'd ever witnessed a lynch mob, an Israeli lynch mob, of basically Jewish supremacists marching down Jaffa Street, midtown Jerusalem, looking for a Palestinian victim.
And you witnessed this?
This was what was going on downtown, and this lasted for basically weeks. The next morning was the morning Muhammad Abu Khadir, a 15-year-old boy from Shuafat neighborhood, was napped and burned alive in a forest outside his neighborhood. And the Jewish supremacy groups had gained basically domination over the city streets. They were setting up booths, handing out stickers saying revenge on them, selling T-shirts with supremacy lines on them and emblems. And the mayor, who was a very business-oriented mayor, kept on saying, everything's good, don't worry about it, business as usual, basically. Nobody had actually called this out. And it lasted for weeks.
Did the international press not pick up on it?
The international press that covers the blogs like Mondo Weiss or Electronic Intifada or 972 on the Israeli side, Palestinian press, but not the major press, no. And on the Israeli side, I mean, I work in a Palestinian organization, and my colleagues and friends were scared. They were afraid. They said, enough, we're not walking around Israeli streets anymore. And on the Israeli side, we were organizing for a protective presence. I had a list of 70, 80 activist phone numbers on my phone, and anytime anybody would see a mob marching up Jaffa Street, we'd send a text out to everybody saying, mob on its way to the corner of King George and Jaffa. If anybody's in the area, please show up and stand between the mob and the victim. This is basically what we did for weeks. We took shifts, especially in the afternoons and the evenings when tension levels were rising. Now, that's not the case anymore. Things have calmed down in Jerusalem, but basically what happened on the Israeli streets is we're out of the closet, so to speak. We're out, we're saying, we're racist, we're violent, and we're proud, is the shift. Now, not that we've always been racist. The Zionist movement, when it comes to those policies that we've been describing in Jerusalem, those are all racist policies, but it's never been out of the closet the way we are now. And that's something I think we need to come to terms with. All of us need to come to terms with.
I mean, lynch mobs. There are so many things in what you're saying and what I've been witnessing from afar, of course. I can't help but thinking about, the attitude, the hatred, that sense of we want to kill somebody, lynch mobs, of kind of like 1940s and 50s Southern U.S. whites and their attitude toward Black Americans.
This is new to me, also. I got to be honest, it's a scary moment in Jerusalem history. That's what's going on the Israeli side. On the Palestinian side, what I think I'm witnessing, and I can't speak for Palestinians, but I can, for what I'm witnessing, there's confusion within a younger generation who's looking to the elders that have consistently failed, right? It's been the Fatah or the Hamas or the PFLP or the Palestinian Authority that have always consistently been losing lands, been losing rights, been giving up human rights. That was basically the negotiation table in the 90s at the peace talks, where we'll give you our right to self-determination. We'll give you our freedoms in return for peace. There wasn't land for peace in the end of the day. Israel wasn't granting land. It was occupied land that wasn't Israel's to negotiate to begin with. And in the meantime, unemployment rates are rocketing and dropout rates are rocketing. And we're watching as a younger generation is leaving. Like there's no future in Jerusalem for a younger generation. And what was proven to a younger generation this last summer, with a horrific price, was that Hamas managed to get Palestine on the map again. Like it or not, and I know what Americans may think of Hamas, when it comes to local discussion on the street in Jerusalem, where other political parties have failed, Hamas put Palestine on the map, and Israel at the negotiation table. And Netanyahu, there were negotiations down in Cairo. So they proved that violence works. Right, that's what was proven over this last summer. However, at the negotiation table, not even the Hamas, not even after that horrific price, over 2,000 casualties, hundreds of innocent kids that were killed. Not only could they not negotiate water in the West Bank or Jerusalem as the capital, they couldn't. All they could negotiate was a siege, was lifting the siege of Gaza, and they failed even that. Nothing was given. And so a younger generation is looking at the adults and the political parties saying, what have you accomplished over the last decades? So violence works, but also violence doesn't work, but negotiations don't work. And that's on the Palestinian side, that's a very scary moment. And on the Israeli side, our Jewish supremacy that is outed now also is a very scary moment. I think, when it comes down to paying attention to what we're discussing, I think we need to pay attention to this. And on top of that, to maybe reframe it, people get very daunted. Biblical context, this is historic, it's very complicated. Like when I was growing up, everybody kept on saying, this is very, very complicated. We're not going to be able to resolve it overnight. And you know what? I don't think it's all that complicated. I think a bottom line here is, you know what's really complicated? To justify injustice. That's really complicated. To justify not giving African Americans a vote, that's complicated. You have to really bend your mind to come up with why that makes sense. The same way you have to bend your mind to come up with why it makes sense that if you're not Jewish in Jerusalem, you don't have the right to vote. That's very complicated. But justice and equality, those are not complicated concepts. Those are simple concepts.
It seems, to call it for what it is, speaking of simplicity, the idea is, from Israel's perspective, although they won't say this, is to try to get rid of every single Palestinian living within the borders of what is called Israel, what you call Palestine. Just make them all go away. And the injustice of that, the horror of that, is self-evident, and you've been describing it in much detail, but they seem to be winning every battle. The world looks on in horror, but doesn't really do very much. So what's another outcome? What's the better outcome? What's your vision or hope?
Ooh, that's a tough question. But I tell you what, we're all daunted by the bigger picture because it's biblical and it's complicated. And granting voting rights to people is obviously too far away right now. What we have in the book right now is we're displaying over 80 different community-based organizations. There are layers and layers of disempowerment in Palestine, whether it's the military occupation, the economic occupation, the fact that civil services are withheld and there's no community center to organize at, or that the humanitarian agencies of the world, the UN agencies, are there providing civil services. Imagine FEMA was running the show in your city, in different languages with different audit requirements.
Right, FEMA was picking up the garbage and issuing building permits.
Imagine it was FEMA. Yeah. Like we all know, like criticism to FEMA and the mess that it is. But imagine FEMA was speaking German, French, Italian, and English, and they all had different budgets and they needed to coordinate that. That's kind of what civil services look like in Palestinian neighborhoods across the West Bank and in Jerusalem. Our job right now, I think anybody who's working in solidarity, is to support a grassroots Palestinian leadership to fill in the gaps where disempowerment exists, to participate, for young Palestinians to find a way to say, this is what I want for my future, this is what I want my community to look like, this is what I want my city to look like, and to start working towards that. The international community, the solidarity around the world has grown over the last 10 years. 10 years ago, if somebody would have described the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement the way it's functioning today, we'd have all said, you're dreaming, that's never going to happen. But all over the world, there are chapters, there are solidarity groups on campuses everywhere. And the divestment campaign is working, sanctions on the Israeli economy is happening, and we're all very clear on what we're against, on what we're opposing. It's a brilliant tactic, and it's gaining momentum. Now we can shift gears and start saying, this is what we want things to look like. Asking Palestinian leaders in the area, and that's the idea when we map grassroots organizations. Asking them, where do you see your lives in 10 years? And I got to be honest, for the most part, the answer is, what are you talking to me about 10 or 3 years? We're unemployed and we're dealing with house demolitions. But still, as a solidarity movement, a global one, we can strategically create platforms for that kind of participation, for those kind of questions to ask, so we can answer them and support the local answers. It's not about what I want for Jerusalem right now. It's about what my Palestinian colleagues and friends want. I swim in privilege. When it comes to learning what being an ally is, working in solidarity, it's learning where I can support. And I think that's what we can do around the world.
So often when we talk about Israel, Palestine, this entire situation, which looks really bleak for so many reasons, and the power imbalance is so gigantic, it seems hopeless to me. Do you have a sense? I mean, what is your own feeling about that? About the real future of this area, of Jerusalem?
Of what we're creating, not just what we're opposing?
Yeah.
Again, if we had to sit down and imagine and describe what Jerusalem's going to look like in a decade or two decades once we resolve this, once there's freedom of movement from the suburbs into the central business district and people are employed, there's access to healthcare, and cultural platforms can host anybody, we're going to be a beautiful cosmopolitan metropolis where Jews and Muslims and Christians feel at home. All sorts of Jews and Muslims and Christians, by the way. I mean, right now people don't know that the old city has an African Palestinian community, has a Gypsy Palestinian community. In Palestine we have Baha'i, we have Druze, we have all sorts of different Christians and all sorts of different Jews. It's going to be a beautiful place.
You think?
We don't have much of a choice. It has to be. I mean, Jerusalem can be on par with Berlin and Madrid and Melbourne and other global capitals. Of course it needs to be that. When we resolve this...
But basically what's required for that is a genuine democracy of all citizens, of all residents of that land.
Based on equality and justice. Yes, it's going to be, that's the capital that Jerusalem is going to become. It'll connect Tel Aviv to Amman, and we'll be able to take the train again all the way to Beirut. In my lifetime, I want to go visit Beirut. I hear it's an awesome city.
Now, you are a young, middle-class man from Jerusalem. Your parents were Zionists from the U.S. and Canada, went to Israel with this beautiful dream, as so many did. How did you shift into the work you're doing now, and are there a lot of other young Jewish people like you?
We each have our own journey. Mine began with growing up in Jerusalem as a scout. I was a proud Israeli scout. I learned to be a patriot. I wore a uniform for about 13, 14 years of my life. Started preparing for my military service in the fourth grade. And through the 90s, as peace was around the corner, but bombs were still blowing up, it became very obvious to me that I wanted to serve my country. I wanted to be a combat soldier. I wanted to serve and protect. And I grew up to a peacenik family, but we didn't know any settlers, and I didn't know any Palestinians. By the time it was my turn to serve in the army, the second Intifada had already erupted, and it was violent, and it was terrible. It was the worst 3 years to serve in the Israeli military, and I witnessed firsthand what the violent occupation actually is. We were told that we were protecting, but in fact our job was to support this Israeli settlement expansion with basically Jewish supremacist ideals. It took me a long time to wrap my brain around the fact that we weren't just there to protect the settlers. We were there to support them and enable their expansion. And it wasn't just a bunch of fringe lunatics, supremacists with guns that the Israeli government can dismiss. This is the government. They are pawns of the government. It is the Israeli government's policy to expand at the expense of the Palestinians. They hadn't finished the job in 1948. There's still Palestinians in the West Bank, and we're still continuing to push them out. Whole villages with displacement orders in the South Hebron Hills. Jalin Bedouin, a lifestyle that is all but erased, living between Jerusalem and Ramallah right now. 4,000, 5,000 people with displacement orders on their tents because they don't have permits to build a tent according to the master plan. And by the end of my army service, I really wanted my mother to understand what all that meant. I could barely understand what it all meant, but I needed to explain. I needed to share this. Hebron, I was serving in Hebron. It's an hour's drive south of Jerusalem, but it's worlds apart. The settlers, the supremacist settlers back then were very unique. Right now, they're front and center in Jerusalem, but back in 2004, they were still considered fringe, and I needed my mother and I needed my family and my surroundings to understand who these people really were. And I also wanted them to understand what it meant for us to control people. Like, what does it mean for an 18, 19, 20-year-old kid to control a civilian population? And we formed an organization called Breaking the Silence, and that's what that became. We collected testimonies from units from all over the IDF saying, this is how we control a civilian population, and this is how we become monsters, not because we're a bunch of rotten apples, but because that's the reality of controlling people. That's just what's going to happen.
Now, did your family understand?
They've always been very supportive, but what I'm actually doing is questioning the very validity of an ideology, of the Zionist ideologies, which are in essence putting a Jewish national state at the expense of anybody else who's not Jewish. It happens to be the Palestinians that we landed on. Could have been anybody else, but the fact of the matter is, if you're not Jewish, you don't have the right to a citizenship in Israel. It's not. It's a democracy for Jewish people, not a Jewish democracy. It's a democracy for Jewish people.
So, circling back, you and your many colleagues who contributed to this book, Wujud, the Grassroots Guide to Jerusalem, now have a book that people can read when they or can study or can use, and it has all the transportation and taxis and cell phones and hotels and restaurants and all of that, particularly in Palestinian parts of Jerusalem. You're kind of not making me want to come.
Sorry about that. Listen, come. We'll have a good time. If there's anything that you will feel and experience in Jerusalem, it's real. It's visceral. People that come are immediately addicted to the fact that we're not woo-woo. We're as grounded as things get. People are angry in the street or they're loving in the street. Whichever it is, it's real stuff. People are going to be as honest as they can be. And I think you'll appreciate that. I think you'll appreciate the candor, and I think you'll appreciate the straightforwardness of a discussion.
Will they let me into the country if I'm carrying this guidebook?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe put it in the... Don't take it on the carry-on. Maybe keep it in the you know, down at the bottom of the airplane.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Mika Kurtz, and for your new guidebook, Wujud, the Grassroots Guide to Jerusalem. If people want to find out more about your work, how can they do so?
You can Google grassrootsalquds.net. You're more than welcome to email me if you want, mika@grassrootsalquds.org.
I will put links to all of that on my website, which is santafe.radiocafe.org.
Great. And you know what? I can imagine that a lot of listeners are probably going to have a very hard time with a lot of the stuff that we discussed. And I'm going to acknowledge a certain learning curve and how painful it is to deal with that on a personal level. I mean, it's been a tough learning curve for me. It's very steep, and my family is also dealing with it, and anybody who lives in the area is going to have to come to terms with the fact that Israel and Palestine are the same place. Personally, I don't really care anymore what label we give it. It's equality and justice that I think we can be focusing on. I think those are the most important ideals, and the rest we can handle. We can handle it nonviolently, not militarily.
Mika Kurtz, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure and an honor.